Hi, I'm Joel.
And I'm Kishan.
And this is Tea for Two.
This is our BFF podcast, where we talk about anything from science to popular culture,
the arts and life in Singapore. Hi everyone, it's me, Joel, a playwright and performer.
And it's me, Kishan, a science educator.
And welcome back to T42! It is our best friend podcast, where we talk about whatever the fingering we want!
Wow, fingering, like, is it pointing?
Huh?
Is it pointing? Is fingering?
No, fingering pointing. Is the thing when you play piano.
I knew it. Then
you have to choose the right fingering
of
to
course.
Make the most economical use of your hand across
Ooh.
The scale.
Ooh, what a beautiful definition.
Fingering is also the thing if you play clarinet, for example. Yeah. It's the same thing. Yeah,
right. Fingering is also sexual stimulation.
Huh, is it? Huh? Ayo. Hey, don't let every...
Are you blushing?
Hot under the collar.
Hot flush.
Let it be known though, fingering, one of my favorite sex acts.
Really?
Yeah, I think.
Thanks for sharing.
I think incredibly underrated in the gay male sexual playbook.
Just in the game.
Just yeah, in the game generally.
Where there are orifices,
finger them.
Yeah.
Nose also can.
I mean carefully lah.
How are you, Kishan?
I am good. Just glad to be here as always. Mm. Glad that the week is, you know, over.
I am, as usual, hungover.
Oh, so fast.
Yeah, and I'm drinking again.
Barely a minute in. Well done, sis. Mm.
Oh, we have someone in the room today, don't we?
It's got presents.
It's got presents.
Is it Pontiana?
I heard that. It's very cold.
Your aircon.
Yeah, wait. I think. Hey, wait. Oh my god. It's.
Oh my god. Who is this?
It's yet another episode of T42. For three, we've got a very special guest on today. And if you recognize that clip, you will know who is on the show. Mm-mm-mm. It's none other than. Wish! Say hi, Wish.
I've been trying so hard to be quiet this whole time through your whole fingering thing.
Because fingering was the word you suggested.
I did suggest it exactly in the context of piano.
Correct,
clarinet.
Right? But then it's like if you know, you know.
I don't know.
How fingering was that?
These fellas tell me to keep quiet until they intro me. I'm like here gasping.
How are you, Wish?
Yes, how are you, sis?
I'm good. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Long time listener of the show.
First time caller.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, can I dedicate a song?
Yeah, I can.
No, don't. FYI, Joel Tan pitched that up. So that's not my real voice.
No, it's, huh? It's not me?
It is not.
I'm pretty sure that's
like
within your range,
up.
Though.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah,
can
okay.
La, can.
For some added context, for those of you don't know who the fuck this woman is,
yeah.
Wish is a singer songwriter.
That's right.
A writer. Mm. Sometimes a theater maker.
I guess.
Yeah, I guess. And like you will most recently have heard this.
Oh no.
As the opening to the Aware podcast, which we've talked about to great length on this show.
That's right. Mm. Yeah.
So, hi, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Lovely to have you here.
Mm. Yeah, Wish and I go. Quite far back.
Yeah, how do you guys know each other?
How do we know each other, Wish?
I always tell this story differently to you.
Okay, please tell the
what
story.
What is today's iteration?
My story is generally quite innocent. Like, oh, we met in school, like back in uni.
Oh, yeah. We did. We did English degree together at the University of Mordor. Must not be named.
Correct. Must not be named.
What do you say you tell the story innocently?
Yeah. Somebody told me that the way you tell this story is that like we hated each other at the start because we like disagreed on some
necessary
shit.
Yes.
And then we like you thought I was a bitch. And then I thought you were damn amchio. Then we were
amchio.
Was I though?
I think we were children back then. Yeah.
Isn't it funny how like you look back at people in that time of life, right? In their early 20s, and they are literally children.
Yeah. Mm. But, you want to laugh.
Yeah, but at that time you just think like, oh my god.
I'm the shit, right? Yeah.
And now you look at it, it's like, shh, just keep quiet. Just keep quiet. Don't need to talk so much.
Don't talk. Yeah. Absolutely right.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, this episode, we're not gonna be talking about Wish's music career because it's so boring, right?
Boring,
like the most
boring.
Obvious thing to talk to you about is like
the one
music. The one. Who won?
Nobody.
Nobody. Maybe a little known fact about Wish. Is that she was last time a teacher.
Correct.
And then our good friend here, Kishan, is also now a teacher.
That's right, in case you didn't know.
Yeah, in case you didn't know. So I feel like that makes a very good kind of context to talk about.
Good morning, teacher!
Cool! Today's gonna be a deep chat on the topic of school.
That's right.
Yeah, we have so much to talk about though.
We really do. Buckle in, people.
Buckle in and like gird your loins for all the trauma that's about to spill into your ears.
Gird your loins next to school. Sounds very wrong.
Yeah, better than fingering.
This one really like ghosts, like ghosts come back. Scary.
Yeah, if you know, you know. So, what schools did everybody go to? Should we start with Weish, our guest?
Yeah.
We were just talking about this. Okay, so I come from Raffles.
Boos.
Yeah.
When you think of Raffles, you think of Slytherin for some reason, right?
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think the color is the same.
As in, which part of the Raffles ascendancy did you join?
Actually, it was a weird thing because I was previously in SEGS.
Yeah.
And then I think some sort of interview situation cropped up in the end of Sec 2 where you had the chance to apply, and then the perk was you don't have to do your O levels, like you go through all the way to JC and you secure a spot at RJC.
The IP program, lah.
Yeah, which I mean, which I don't stand by now. Looking back at it, I don't think it's a good system.
I mean, obviously, back then you're just doing whatever you think makes sense.
Well, and my parents forced me to. I didn't want to leave.
Yeah. SEGS. How old were you at SEGS before you transferred?
From primary 1 to sec 2.
Oh my god, you must have had so many friends you left behind and everything.
Yeah.
Hey, SEGS, is it the sleeveless one?
Yeah.
Was it
the
you?
The cannot grow armpit hair.
Yeah, that's the one.
I have a very vivid image in my head of, I don't know who told me, but like on the bus, it was
it's
you, right?
Me.
What's the story?
You planted this image in my head where one of the early times we met, about SEGS girls on the bus, and it was raining and they're all holding the rails on the bus, right? And then like the water is just dripping down their armpit hair.
What?
Yeah. Okay. You planted this very vivid image in my head.
Maybe that and Nanyang girls. Oh, we have it bad.
Actually, do the teachers tell y'all like to shave? Like,
nobody tells us anything.
Then how your seniors tell you like, hey, masa, or what?
So, or you just shamed into it.
How is this wonderful knowledge passed down?
Actually, most of us who are lucky enough to have seniors that we're close to will be like, hey, your armpit is going to come out soon. Go do something about it. If not, you know, you will pay the social price.
The social price being what?
Shame.
Being like shame. And there were a small percentage of girls who didn't receive the wisdom, didn't get the memo, and
then how?
Would either be so ashamed that they would just wear our school jacket, which was this thick woolly thing, constantly, even in the sun.
So like more armpit hair, lah.
More armpit sweat. Yeah.
It's really swampy.
Yeah, it looked swampy. And so poor thing, because you know why they're sweating it out in there. Either that, or they would just have these big bushy pits that like other girls would make fun of.
It's horrible that they're shamed into it, though, right?
Yeah. It's just such an awkward thing.
This
to go
is
through.
A delightful tangent, because I actually think that armpit hair on women is hot.
Thank you.
I think it's really hot. And I mean, this is, I really just, I understand the cultural reasons for why a woman's pits must be smooth, but like, I think this is something that's eventually going to die out at some point.
I hope so too. No, I've noticed recently, and I really appreciate that, more women are.
Yeah, that's true.
It's really hot.
Oh, it's hot. I'm quite indifferent about it, but okay. Yeah.
Actually, I find men who shave their pits, especially gay men shave their pits, right?
That's
like,
true.
It just weirds me out. It's very weird.
It's this strange need to regress into a child.
Yeah. I think that's what it is,
I know. It really is.
With gay men in particular, is this regression to childhood.
Yeah,
and
it's bizarre.
Yeah, it's very weird.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
I find armpit hair very sexy in men.
Yeah, I love the smell of it.
The muskiness.
Mm. Yeah.
I see. Okay, lovely. Lovely. Cool. You know, now that you brought up Raffles.
Swift pivot.
I'm gonna pivot away from this conversation. I used to teach in Raffles Institution, right? And I had boys so I didn't go to a school like Raffles Institution.
Which school did you go to?
I went to Hai Sing Catholic.
Ah.
Hai Sing Catholic, like right near where you live, Joel, where both of you live, actually. So I didn't go to like a school like Raffles Institution, right? And I used to teach there, and there were kids who
I would notice as they would leave the school, they would take out their school badge. And it was very interesting.
Wait, who would take out their school badge?
The kids.
The Hai Sing kids?
When I was teaching Raffles Institution, I would notice the kids would take off their school badge as they leave the school. And I was very perplexed. But I was like, why would you take off your school badge? And then after I got to know kids a little bit better, and then after they graduated, they told me it's because they felt they felt like a bit shamed that they were from Raffles Institution. They didn't want to be seen that they were from Raffles Institution. And I couldn't understand this because coming from a neighborhood school, I was like, wow, why are you not proud? Are you from RI? You should be proud, what? So it was a bit of a turnaround for me to understand that they felt some sort of shame.
What is the shame? Like, can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, I suppose so. I still hesitate till today.
To talk
at
about
the tender age
right,
of 31.
31, yeah.
To say.
Yeah, because sometimes adults can really be children. And I just remember teaching at my first school, not going to name names. And like, it's one of the first things people ask you, what school you go to last time. I'm like, why you want to know so long ago?
It's a whole like language of
assessing.
Sorting people,
yeah,
right?
Like, sorting.
Yeah, one of the first things that will come up in a conversation between any two Singaporeans is very likely which schools you go to,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's so troubling. And so I kind of like, don't tell you, kind of.
Like, then let them guess, right?
Sometimes, but then it just makes the matter worse.
Yeah,
so
isn't
that
more
like,
tantalizing?
No, because then when you finally reveal it, they go like, ugh, of course.
Yeah, right, it's right. Gross. So like all paths lead to, you know, a bad outcome. And it was just like, she from Raffles. Then straight away, like, everybody knows and it's a thing. But I mean, I don't
think
I should whinge about it.
No, it is what it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of just privilege.
Okay, so like, I came from from Montfort Secondary School, right? Which is a very little known boys' school. It's one of like the least known boys' schools in Singapore, but it's one of the oldest. But we are basically a neighborhood school in Hougang. So I like to say that I went to a Longkang Secondary School because it's literally next to a Longkang.
LKSS.
LKSS.
I think before we started recording, we should print it on a t-shirt. So Longkang Secondary School,
yeah, correct.
Right? I mean, that's terrible. It's a pretty okay school.
Yeah, don't call Longkang la.
Yeah. No, but I'm bringing this up because like I remember feeling when I was in secondary school, even in primary school, you could feel the differential between the quality of schools, right? It's something that even as a kid, I noticed that. Because sometimes we would have competitions that we go to these elite schools like ACS or whatever, right? And then we would really feel the quality of education, the resources that I will never forget. Like
resources.
Did you do Odyssey of the Mind when you were in school?
Oh, yes, I did.
You did, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so Odyssey of the Mind was this kind of like creative thinking competition, right? Where all the aquas and the weird kids would go and do acting challenges or whatever. And so like they always had the championships at ACS for some reason.
Oh.
Yeah, because ACS Independent was like one of the biggest like they sent the most teams and it did very well and like they always hosted the championships there, right? So the first time we went to ACS, I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, it's massive building. They had like huge lecture theaters and so many rooms, and the canteen was massive and had very nice brownies. I'll never forget. All these boys walking around like these gorgeous gods because they were so tan from all their swimming. And I'll never forget, like, because the Montfort uniform was white and blue as well, just like ACS, right? When our little troop of Longkang Secondary School boys came off the bus and went in, this like fucking ACS boy, like sec 4 or whatever, walks over and was like, oh, hey, where are you guys from? With a distinct kind of like American accent in the voice.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, we're from Montfort. Ah, interesting. Welcome to ACS.
Ew.
Are you serious?
It was so fucking gross. Yeah.
But interesting. Yeah. Welcome to ACS.
No, it was very hot as well. Like, I can't like... Yeah,
quiver a bit.
Quiver. A girl did quiver. Yeah, but I guess the point is that, like, you know, I can understand why kids who go to these really elite schools, especially Raffles in particular, which is like the target of all of this critique about elitism, will feel a bit paisei about,
It's not just a bit paisei, I think. I think growing up in a system that doesn't recognize privilege, and we can talk about this a little more later in depth, but like a system that teaches you that it's meritocratic, and then you grow up thinking like, wow, I damn smart, I got here all on my own because I have brains. And then I guess as the layers start to peel off and you realize how many systemic factors there are in that have played a part in your own success and how little you actually deserve that place, the Pisces is really amplified. Like, you really feel like you should never have been there and that the resources haven't been spread equally. And
but was this something that, like, dawned on you while you were at this elite school, or is it something that's kind of post-fact that
too late in life, like, so ashamed that I held certain thoughts till, like, you know, 16, 17,
right?
And being surrounded by fellow elitists, I suppose, who, you know, get out of my elite uncaring face, right?
Yeah,
all of that.
It was such
the dominant narrative at the canteen tables. Yeah, they're like, oh, that school, ha ha ha. Like,
But
I mean, the flip side to this is all the students who didn't go to these schools, right? They also didn't understand the meritocratic fallacy. They also thought that they deserve what they got, lah. You know, and which is very sad. You know, I didn't go to Raffles Institution, for example, but my father, I remember at the end of PSLE, right, I was like, remember you had to, like, rank your 6 choices for the schools or something like that?
God.
Yeah, so my father made me put Raffles Institution the first one. I was like, there's no way I'm getting in. It's impossible. He was like, no, lah, just put. So it was exalted, you know, to this height, right? So I knew I was never going to get in.
But
so,
you did it anyway.
Yeah, because he made me, I mean, let's face it, the choices the parents put one, I didn't put any of them, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
So all these students, they feel like they are the ones, they are failures, you know, and what they do is that they put up this like fake image of like, oh, it's okay, you know, no big deal. Oh, look at those nerds, whatever. And so this is the defense mechanism. And I think it creates a terrible, terrible rift between these two groups of students, which carries on to adulthood, which is why, like what you said, those things happen. Like, you start to make fun of people of certain primary school, certain secondary schools or wherever they come from, even right through adulthood.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't help, lah.
Yeah,
a lot doesn't help. Like, I went to Montfort for 10 years. So I went to the primary school and the secondary school. Right, so in primary school,
why you were there for 10 years?
Yeah, I was 10 years in a boys' school. Can you see why?
Can
yeah,
this yeah, wow. Such boys' school material.
Correct, right? Yeah. We had this music teacher called
Montfort's number one sister.
Yeah, Montfort's number one. They never ask me back for anything, like, you know, all the things I've achieved in my life, right, they'd rather dissociate themselves from me. It's like, this one better don't claim, this one better don't claim. No, but we had this music teacher in primary school called Mrs. Dolly Wan.
Oh, best.
Side note, we just all call her $1.
My gosh.
That's terrible.
No, but she was monstrous, right? So, like, Montfort was in Hougang, right? And then she had this chip on her shoulder about people from Hougang. So she would always just scold us, going like, all you Hougang people don't know how to behave. Like, she's probably
she Peranakan. Like that,
probably Peranakan.
Yes, like,
Jolly one.
Actually, Montfort got a lot of the teachers, they talk with this accent. They all these Anglo-Indian, all these Anglo-Peranakans, and like, they teach in the mission school. She's like, all you Hougang children are terrible. The parents don't teach you proper manners. And then she would just scream at us constantly. And then imagine going to receiving that kind of reinforcement on the daily. And then, like, we were a bit of a rough school, lah, so it was a very abeng school. And, I mean, boys will be boys, right? That's, you know, and it was boisterous and not the most sophisticated environment, sure, but there was a lot that was good about it. But I think we were also constantly made to feel like we were a shitty school.
Goodness.
Yeah. And it was enforced by teachers.
Absolutely.
You know, you could definitely feel in the energy that they thought very little of us. You know,
you were compared against constantly.
And then, like, I also remember sometimes, like, some later in secondary school, we had teachers who had taught in better schools before who would just constantly make these comparisons. And then, or we would always get the test papers, you know, like they get sample exams from other schools, right? So we always made to do the papers from better schools as a challenge to us. Mm. So it's kind of like, oh, if you can do this paper, because, like, you know, like, it was like Catholic High.
Yeah.
You know, they set the paper very difficult.
Right.
So if you can do it, then you're fine.
But I mean, some teachers thrive on these differences or in emphasizing these differences. And especially, you see it especially in schools with different streams. I mean, most schools have different streams. And the difference in any kid can see Mr. Tan walk into express class versus Mr. Tan walk into NA and T is a totally different person. And why are you Mr. Tan version Jekyll or Hyde when you go into these different classes? And it completely changes how they view the teachers or the adults who look at them, and it also changes how they look at themselves.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
And it's all of these ways in which, like, when you're in primary school, for example, and you're sitting for your PSLE, right, the teachers really strike the fear of fucking God in you about going into normal. God forbid.
I remember that.
It's very like, if you don't survive your PSLE, you'll go to normal. And then if you go to normal, huh, you will, like, your life forever finish already.
Your life forever finish.
No, but there's always a terrible place that you should never end up, like ITE. So if it's not normal, it's ITE. If it's not ITE, it's basically anything that is not university. It's like, that's the end goal of education, it feels.
Yeah.
Like, oh, God forbid you go to a poly. What's wrong with a poly? In fact, polys are great.
Yeah, they are.
They're amazing.
I just want to introduce a thought that we can chew on a little bit, right? It's the idea that actually, if you are not a self-reflexive and critical individual as an adult, right, what damage are you doing to young people?
So much.
Right?
And
because this conversation we're having is a fairly critical and progressive one, right? But, like, I don't imagine it's a conversation that's had at Nier. I don't imagine that it's a conversation that's had amongst teachers in the open. Like, you know, I see your body language, Kishan, sometimes when you talk about these things, right, that you do kind of shrink, or not shrink, but, like, you measure your words very carefully.
I do,
and I, you know, because you are a public servant, right, and these are difficult conversations to have.
Yep.
So I can just imagine that the orthodoxy actually doesn't admit very much of this kind of criticality, and that's a problem. Because,
it's very actively quashed.
Yeah,
actually.
It's quashed, right? Yeah. I mean, I just think it's interesting that we're having this conversation about schools as breeding grounds for elitism, you know, in the context of what's happening right now in the political sphere in Singapore with, like, the crisis in leadership renewal. Because I just think it's very interesting that political leadership in this country has historically been funneled through elite education, right? So much faith has been put in this so-called meritocratic system to kind of, like, automatically filter out the best, the cream of the creme de la creme, right? But clearly that seems to have failed us, because there is not enough. What we're seeing now is that there is not enough young political talent that's come through this system that people have faith in, right?
There's not enough different sort of talent.
Yeah,
everything
it's
seems
very homogenous.
Like a facsimile of everything else.
Correct.
It's just like, why? You know,
but
I want something different.
But then it also makes you wonder, and I guess this is something we could talk about, right? Actually, when you go through this very elite education, right, what actually does that produce? Obviously, the one thing that's coming up over and over again is just like, these people just come out fucking out of touch with everything.
It's the ivory tower thing. Mm. And that's especially because we are so deliberately kept in our own bubbles. Mm. And just the types of things that are censored in schools, the types of things that teachers are not just not allowed to address, but are supposed to silence when they hear these types of discussions happening in the classroom. You know, privilege, race, class, like, we can't talk about these things, and only, like, if you're a lit teacher, you can indirectly talk through some characters
and
their plight.
Shakespeare.
Shakespeare.
Yeah, you work very hard to go, Shakespeare was saying this to the king.
Can apply to your life.
Yeah.
Think about it. So far away, nobody would think about it.
I think, like the education system that we were put through compared to the education system now, the education system has no choice but to mature and to talk about these things, right? So I see, as a teacher, I see a lot more of these things coming in. Sure, certain things are still very, very, very taboo, like queerness, for example. It's still, like, treated with kids' gloves. You know, it's very, very difficult. But a lot more is coming in. But those conversations that are coming in, I hesitate to say this, but it feels a little bit scripted. You know, you can now talk about race.
But only,
here is what we can say. You know,
only in this way.
I think this is a step in the right direction. Don't get me wrong. I mean, and I'm not saying this because, you know, like, oh, you know, like, I don't want to get fired. Yeah, but don't fire me. But I truly think
if you're listening, Emily, please don't fire Kishan.
I'm one of the good
He's one of the good ones. He's one of the really good ones.
But I think it's a step in the right direction, because at least there is acknowledgement that we cannot keep our heads buried in the sand. Then the kids are going to find out these things anyway. Social media is insane. So better we have conversations with people who can possibly be trained to have good conversations about these things. Of course, the question mark is then, how do we train these people? And what is the final message that would be distilled from this? That is a whole other issue.
And there's so many gaps that are missing, like, where to even start. And I think at a very base level, you know, beneath race and all other types of inequality, just the basic concept of privilege is completely not addressed. So in my very first year of teaching, or first few years, I was debate teacher in charge, one of. And we had, I guess, a neighborhood school. We were going up against, I think, Hua Chong.
One of those.
And so we're at this debate tournament, and the motion was, this house believes that all our successes and failures are completely our own doing, or something to that effect.
Mm.
And, you know, it's I was like, okay, great. You know, we were to argue against that. So Hua Chong had to argue that, yes, all our successes and failures are completely within our control. And my school had to say no.
So your school would have taken the structural inequality position.
Correct.
Right, okay.
Except that didn't happen.
Yeah? What did they... What happened?
It was so painful and so sad to watch because they were pretty much just waffling or accidentally arguing against their own motion. They couldn't come up with a single argument that inequality, privilege, discrimination, any structural inequality.
They couldn't see it.
Mm. They just,
wow, it's so heartbreaking.
And they were 16 years old. They just couldn't see it. And I was like, these kids, is this how you've been living your life? Just believing that all of your setbacks and all of your, the discrimination that you face is your own fault?
It's so... Because on one hand... Someone might argue, oh, at 16, what would they know about structural inequality, so on and so forth, right? But actually, I've been listening to this podcast called Nice White Parents, which basically is this 5-episode deep dive on white gentrification of the school system in New York, right? And basically how the school system there is stratified by race, is segregated by race, basically. And I heard these high school kids, 14, 15, 16 years old, just speaking so eloquently about precisely these things, about structural inequality, about how some schools are better funded, some schools have better programs, some schools have better teacher-to-student ratios and all that. And they could speak, they could see it, because these are conversations that they do have, that they are not, you know, prevented from having.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, actually, young people are perfectly able to see these things. There's no reason why those students could not have made those arguments had they been exposed to those conversations. But I guess what we're saying is that there is a blanket of orthodoxy that wants to prevent people from seeing any of these inequalities at all, right? And then, like, we are told constantly, all schools are good schools, all schools are good schools. But the material experience of that is so untrue. You just know that there are schools that are better and treated better, and that there are schools that are not.
Yeah. Right? Also, I think this idea of meritocracy is really, really, really important for the government to keep us, to keep, because it leads to the idea of self-sufficiency and that you have to take care of yourself.
I get that.
You have to take care
that
of
is actually
your parents. You have to make sure that you do your things. So it's an important thing that the government wants to keep. And I don't know if it is the right thing. It just is a full... It starts from young, you know?
I forget actually how central that is to the Singapore way of doing things, which is that actually the government will provide up to a point, but there is always a margin that you need to lift yourself, you know, you need to do for yourself. So you see in arts funding as well, right? The NAC will only give you like 70 to 80% of the funding. The rest of it you have to find for yourself. It translates to health insurance. It translates to everything that the government will never fully pay for anything that you're... So it's interesting now that you've made this connection that this is something that starts from school, right? Where like you're not encouraged to think about structure because you're supposed to be so completely self-dependent, you know, and make the best of the opportunities that are given to you. But, you know, but now we know, because the conversation has come so far amongst adults, right?
Yeah.
That there are so many inequalities, like tuition
is
the main one, right?
Yeah.
Like being able to afford extra classes, being able to, or going to a school where they are ridiculously like superior.
Exactly. So how do you balance this idea of self-sufficiency and responsibility against these inequalities that come up? Like, it's very difficult.
And no, I do see some of the merit of that kind of thinking or messaging, sure, but like to not address its limitations at all, to not view it as a utopian ideal that we're striving towards, but to claim that we've achieved it is a whole different thing. And it sends a completely different, very damaging message to a lot of people at that age, especially
so young.
Tender young-ish. I was very bad at maths in school. Surprise to no one. Very bad in maths. So like in my O-level year for our prelims, which if you remember was instrumental in helping you get into the first 3 months at JC. Do you remember? So yeah, so your grades for prelim would determine where you if you could do JC for first 3 months, right?
That's right, yeah.
I did so badly for my maths paper. Like I practically failed, right? But I did pretty okay in my other subjects. And then my math teacher and the math HOD just sat me down one day and went, Joel, we are going to change your result on the record. We're gonna give you a better grade so that you can qualify to go to JC because we know that we trust that you will eventually pass and we don't want to hold you back from going JC based on this one result.
Rare.
So they basically helped me cheat. Which I was at the time I was like I was very moved at the time because I was like, this feels incredibly illegal.
I'm very moved now.
Yeah. And it just made me think that actually I had very kind and very, very kind teachers at my secondary school because I think they were the kinds of teachers who knew that we were kids who probably felt pretty bad about ourselves. They were very, we had really excellent teachers in secondary school. Like they really just want to help you like succeed.
That's so nice.
It was really nice. Yeah, and I think maybe it was something about that specific Catholic school environment, which was very pastoral, you know, and the teachers really cared for the students. That I think, you know, say what you want about Montfort, like I had a good education there.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, so quite positive lah. You know,
even warms.
Yeah, so I guess like it'd be interesting to cut a segue into talking about your experiences as teachers and like what you loved about the job, what you love or do not love about the job, any kind of like interesting thoughts that might come up from having been in the system for so long.
So I have this very interesting thing that happened to me last week. And so I'm just going to say it and then I'll tell you what I think about it at the end of it. So I was taking my kids out for like a learning journey thing. So I wasn't in school in the second half of the day. And then suddenly I received a message from one of my colleagues. And then she just sent me this picture of an ex-student, okay? And then she says, this boy is looking for you. Are you around? Then my reply was, laugh out loud, who is he? I've never met him before in my entire life.
Momo.
Then I said, maybe it's the mask. Maybe Momo lah. I can't recognize him with the mask down. Then I said, what class? So I was trying to place him lah, because to be perfectly honest, I really am very bad with names. I'm very good with the faces. Now with the mask, it just fucks me up.
Yeah.
You know, so then he said, oh, he was an ex-student from 2 or 3 years ago. And then she gave me his name and class. The thing is, I have never taught this class in my entire life. And when he was in school, his graduating year, it was the first year that I came into the school. So meaning that if I even did teach this class, it was just for relief. So I had no idea who this kid was. And so I thought to let it go, but I couldn't. I was just like, why is this boy looking for me? So it was a mix of like panic and like curiosity lah. So I tracked him down through other people I knew in the class and I got his number. And I basically said to him, say, hi, I heard you were looking for me last week. This is Mr. Kishan. I have to say, I apologize. I don't remember teaching you at all because you said you were in this class, but that was the first year I was in this school. And then he said this. Hi, sir. You might not remember me. I'm reading from the message, but you actually took my class in 2018 at the end of the year. You substituted one of another teacher's class. So I guess, right, like, it was a relief thing. Then he said, yeah, so even though I didn't really know you that well as a teacher, your words that day really stuck with me till this day. Huh. And honestly, you are my inspiration in the O-levels. And so apparently he did well and he went to aerospace engineering all because of something I said in secondary three. It felt good to hear. Okay, it felt good to hear. But I hope he's not listening to this. I feel really bad. But I had no idea what I said. Zero idea
yeah,
of what I said.
Feel
yeah,
you.
These pearls of wisdom just spill from your mouth.
Yeah, like phlegm. But it made me think about it a little bit. I was like, should I text him and say, I'm so sorry, I have no idea what I said. Because I was very curious, like, I really want to know what I said.
I also want to know.
Yeah, we all want to know.
So I actually typed down like this apologetic sounding message, but you know, just to find out what I said, right? But then I deleted it. I was like, no, but because I rationalized it as, I'm very scared that the kid will feel bad that I didn't remember.
Because what is being said is more
important to him for what it is than what it is to me now.
Right.
So let's just let it be lah. So I just said thanks.
It could very well just have been like, you know, make sure to cut your nails.
Yeah.
You know,
it could be very mundane.
Vitamin C.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Or like, today very hot.
Yeah. Eat ginkgo nuts, you know, something, I don't know. So, this is still staying with me. I haven't actually fully processed this, but I think the big takeaway for me for this is that I sometimes never know how much, or I sometimes forget how much we can affect kids. Even the littlest things we say, because they really pick it up like a sponge. Really, really pick it up like a sponge.
Okay.
And now I teach lower sec and upper sec. And the lower sec kids are, oh my God, even more like sponges. So I usually am very careful with the words that I choose in class. I'm actually, like, I really, really think about it. I'm quite a different person in the classroom. But yeah, this just drove home the message that you really can never tell when you are going to affect the child. And I'm glad that I affected this child positively. And I'm glad it worked out. But I also think about all the times that I may have fucked up.
All the time.
Yeah. And I think about that a little bit. I go like, oh no. If this is great, this worked out. But how many times have I inadvertently fucked up? You know? Yeah. So this was heartwarming, but it gave me, you know, a little bit of a think la for a while.
I mean, I must admit, I am a little disappointed that we will never know what it was that you said. But I feel the lesson you're drawing from this is more important.
Huh?
Yeah, you just never know. Do you remember that song from the Stephen Sondheim musical, Into the Woods?
Yes,
Children will listen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we said it earlier, right, that you just never know what people take away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So for me, this is why I became a teacher. I mean, I truly very much believe, as flawed as it is, I keep finding out how flawed it is the older I get, I believe in the power of education. And I believe what it can do. You know, maybe not in a structured sense, but I believe that teaching,
like the individual encounters.
Yeah, the individual. Yes, that's very nicely put. The individual encounters. And I cherish that very, very much.
Yeah.
Like the one-on-one times I have with kids, to talk to them about maybe the science or the subject that I teach, or about just their life, or about the whatever that I'm teaching in class today. Those are amazing moments. Even being in a classroom and like I like the theater of it. It's all very drama. You know, it's great. It's wonderful. I love all of that. So it's these relationships that are so great. And when COVID hit, I know I joked just now, I said like I was very glad that school was out. I think when we all had to go back in under very weird SMM sort of situations, right, school lost a bit of its essence, because the relationship that I could have with kids now physically disappeared. Like I had to keep 1 meter away. I had to wear certain things. We were actually physically not allowed to interact. And that was tough to deal with a little bit, because I didn't then find different ways to emotionally connect with these students, because that's what they all want. They all want some emotional recognition and to be seen.
And I'm so glad people like you exist, because it's just one of the number one things that we get told by older teachers coming in is, don't give your number, keep your heart close. Like, okay, not
is
to that
so
not
right.
to that if not but not like, keep your heart
but
close,
protect but yourself la.
Protect and it's, it is
it comes
good
from a
advice
good place, yeah.
It comes from a good place, and it is a great piece of advice, because I burnt out really early because of how, I guess, openly emotionally available I was. Like, your BGR problem, come to me. Your mother fight, come to me. You know, I was that person.
It's very stressful.
I cherish that now, looking back. Like, I really love having been that person for these kids. But at the time, I really, really, really couldn't handle it. So, you know, it's just so hard to straddle. And then you have school counselors, but kids trust people that they interact with on the daily, that they've built up a relationship with, and to go into this, I guess, faceless person who's probably lovely and great at his or her job or their job, but, you know, to open up about, I don't know, your most vulnerable issues with a person that you haven't had a relationship with is so hard for anyone, let alone, you know, a teenager. But I think any or most teachers I've spoken with would say, like, you just end up loving your students lah. You know, you just be so attached to them that all other opportunities that come your way seem irrelevant. Like, you could, you know, a lot of great teachers are like, I got offered to go HQ, or I got offered to, you know, take on HOD or whatever, and that means I have less face time and less, you know, individual time with the kids, and I'm not willing to give that up. And these are the people that I wish were leaders, but they sacrifice their own sort of growth for you know, more time on the ground, which I really respect as well. So I really don't know how to straddle that.
There's something interesting here about how, you know, you hear about all these people who are like the good ones, right? The good teachers who care very much. And then you all inevitably you hear about how they burn out because it's too much to take on, or the system doesn't protect them, or the system in fact is the thing that ends up wearing them down. Mm. And I think about Faith Ng's play Normal,
oh, Normal,
right?
Yeah.
Which centered, I cry like babies.
It's a beautiful play about the normal stream in Singapore, and how this very idealistic young teacher goes in and is completely destroyed by the system. And she really is. There's that whole, what's that movie, Dead Poets Society. It's a kind of like Dead Poets Society quality to it, where like this very idealistic loving teacher goes in and is slowly destroyed by the system. And you hear that a lot.
It's such a trope. Yeah.
Not just, I mean, to be fair, not just here, but I think
anywhere.
Yeah, because education here is so tied up with questions of class and mobility.
Everywhere
in the world. But in Singapore, there's a kind of specific quality to it as well. It just makes me sad to think that, you know, I know so many people who love doing what they do, but like in order to have longevity in the field, you have to kind of let a part of you die a little bit.
That's very interesting. Mm. So on this idea of burnout, so I always question myself, when will this come? Because I think this is inevitable. I've been very lucky in my education journey. I've had multiple stints, not just in schools. So on some level, you can see that as like a break away from students. But every time you are with students, and I like to form that connection with students, you know, and what will eventually happen is that they will come to you with their problems. Mm. And you try to balance this as much as possible. Because every time they come to you with their problems and they go away, they take a little bit of you with them. Mm. Mm-hmm. And you slowly empty out. You know, you really, really empty out. The answer to that is, answer to the question, when am I going to start feeling burnout, right? I actually felt it a little bit more this year. I was like, oh no, is it coming? Because I started to feel myself emptying out. Like, I couldn't take any more problems from children. I was like, I cannot anymore. It's very tiring. And it talking about this even makes me a little bit emotional, because I know that when the kids come to you, it's a big thing. Leh. Mm. Can you imagine a 14, 15, 16 year old, vulnerable as fuck, come up to you and say, sir, I want to talk to you about something, and they cannot talk to anyone else about this.
Yeah.
And it's a big thing. And
it's huge.
And how can you say no? How can you even possibly say no? So you try and you sit down, but you know at the end of this conversation, you are done for the day, because you cannot do anything else. And then work piles up, and then stress, and the whole structure still maintains, right? But the structure sometimes forgets that we are dealing with humans. Mm. And humans are very, very, very complicated. Forget adolescents, you know, they're just crazy, crazy complicated. So it's very, very, very tiring.
No, and I think on the types of schools I've been in, at least, I haven't had, I mean, it's been very emotionally taxing, like people with family issues, relationship issues, and so on. But I've had friends, I guess I won't name names because got no consent.
Very good, very good.
We'd be out at a movie at like 8 p.m. on a Saturday, and suddenly he'd be like, okay, sorry, I'm bailing, I gotta run. And it's just this kid calls, he's like, Joseph got parang in the...
What?
It's really like, you know, there's so many different types of schools and environments that it's like, a bunch of my secretary boys are now under Jurong something something block with knives. Yeah. I gotta go. Like, you know.
And, quite intense, huh?
Yeah, you just have to drop everything and run, and then decide what to do along the way. Yeah. Do I call police? Do
exactly.
I call mother? Do I call father? Who? It's just these crazy decisions that they have to make on the daily in these types of environments as well. Nobody trains you for that shit.
Exactly. So I think one of the big things about being a teacher is that you are so much more. You are a fucking Swiss Army knife. You know, you are an accountant. You are a counsellor. The teacher is like right down on the list. You know, you are everything else first before you are a teacher. And no one trains you for those things. You sort of pick it up as you go along. And it can be a very steep learning curve for the first few years, because many people don't know that they have to be these things. Mm. And they're so bogged down. Like, oh, how do I do a perfect lesson? How do I do this? How do I get the knowledge across? That... I mean, important, but really far down the list.
Yeah, really far down. Yeah,
really.
I just listening to all this makes me think about how, like, basically teachers are some of the earliest role models children have, because they spend ostensibly more time with teachers than they do their parents, right? Mm. And these are amongst...
Some teachers.
And actually this carries on to, like, even uni. I remember, like, when I was at uni, as old as 21, 22, 23, 24, like looking up to my professors and thinking these are models of people that I would like to be. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge responsibility to put on anybody. But I don't think it's part of teacher training necessarily to think about the kind of human being you are and how do you communicate that aspect of your humanity to your students in a system that's actually very cynical and very inhumane. And you know, so like, you are actually an agent of a system that is saying to students, your value is now determined by the numbers on your scores. Your value is determined by which school you go to. So like, it's this weird thing where you are actually an agent of a fairly inhumane system, but you're also performing this role where you need to be the best human you can be.
Yep.
Right?
I felt that like a lot teaching. And I think I felt finally free from that, trying to craft this perfect version of myself that is worthy of being a role model, by realizing that fallibility and recognizing your own fallibility is a big part of role modeling. And that just appeared in my brain one day, and I was like, oh my god, yeah, I can just make mistakes or be stupid sometimes. Absolutely. And then as long as I own up to them and show that I can see that I fucked up or that I handled the situation badly, then I'm still okay. And that's also a valuable thing to model, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely right. I make it a point to, if I do something wrong with my class or whatever, right, I will say sorry to all of them. I remember the first time I did it, they were shocked, you know.
Yeah.
The first time I did, they were shocked that a teacher was saying sorry to the class and like sincerely apologizing for calling someone out wrongly. Then, I mean, I didn't quite get why they were shocked. And after, upon reflection, then I realized, oh, no one has done this to them before. Yeah. It's a very odd feeling that they kept this, like, they think that humans must be perfect or like we must be perfect.
Yeah. This makes me think very hard, you know, on a question of role modeling about this recent article that the Hacking Unicorn, which is an Instagram page and an online store that kind of does fun advocacy, queer advocacy, right? They released this article where they did a bunch of interviews with people about the school system in Singapore and how it invisibilizes and erases queer experiences. And it made me think, like, yeah, I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, right, just the complete absence of queer role models for me in school, and how like additional, and how like the school system actually is very homophobic, right? It's it's very fucking homophobic in this country, and it has been for very, very long. And so reading the article made me realize, oh, I didn't realize it at the time, but yeah, it was not a good environment for queer people. And you know, we know now that queer teachers aren't allowed to be out about it, even though the ostensibly the government position is that civil servants won't be discriminated against. But we know from history that like it's just a no-go zone for teachers. And then, you know, a recent thing that's recent events with like the trans student Ashley who wanted to transition in school, and how that was kind of like violently clamped down. And it just makes me think of like how, like the point we were making earlier in the podcast about how orthodoxy is bred in the school environment, and how, you know, it's a very inhumane and difficult environment, especially for people who exist on the margins, right? So minority race kids, kids from the working class backgrounds, queer people, and like how, I don't know what the point I'm trying to make is, but I just kind of feel sad about it. That this is replicated. You know, all these things that you go on to experience in adulthood are actually already programmed into the school system from a young age, you know?
Yeah, programmed is one thing. I think it just runs so deep in the blood and the spirit of it as well. I remember this one story. I think it was my second or third year of teaching. Basically, there was a case of molestation in one of my classes. A boy reached his hand into a girl's shirt. And so in the aftermath of it, I was still very, very new, very young, don't know how to deal with these situations. So I just like put a pause on everything. Kids were coming to tell me things, and I went to the discipline master, mistress, who was an ex-police woman, and like she's like revered and feared around the school. Like people see her from far, will like freeze or run, kind of like that kind of really terrifying
Trunchbullian figure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Trunchbullian.
Yeah. So I thought, what better person to go through, like bullies, right? And I remember sitting in front of her, telling her what had happened, and this boy, let's just call him Wei Xiang, something to that effect. was like, what are we going to do about Wei Xiang, and how do we take care of the girl and her well-being and the counselling and blah, 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 blah. Like, what am I supposed to do as their form teacher? And she takes a long look at me and says, it's okay, Wei Xiang is under my wing. I am, you know, he's an at-risk student. So he comes here after school and does homework here under my supervision, and I have it under control. I was like, okay, but what am I supposed to do? And what about the girl? And what is the boy, what kind of discipline is the boy going to face? Am I not allowed to know? Kind of thing. She takes this really long look at me, and then she asks, Wei Xiang, do you believe in Jesus?
I'm sorry.
She's not a Christian.
What?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that came out far out of left field. What's this?
Yeah, I was like, what is happening right now?
And then?
I was like, can we keep to this topic? I just genuinely need to know what to do. She's like, you know, me and all the KPs, the key personnel, like principal, vice principal, HODs, whatever. Me and all the KPs meet every morning before assembly at 6:30 for cell group. Would you like to join us?
Like, oh, hot fuzz. Like, so kind of like freaking, yeah.
I'm trying to understand the process here. Like, what is the, in answer to your question, how is this an answer to your question?
Why are they changing the subject with religion?
I don't know. So at the end of the day, I was like just trying to get answers, and all I would get is, okay, you know what? It's okay. I thank you for reporting to me. I have the situation under control. This kind of case is confidential. And I never found out what happened after that.
Wow. How was the girl? Like, was there a follow-up?
Okay. So like with the girl, I relayed her through the school counselor, and then she told me that her parents were involved in everything, and social service people.
Okay, so it's a more complex situation.
Yeah, so I'm glad that it was actually properly taken care, I think.
Oh my God.
I don't think the boy faced much ramifications actually.
Surprise.
Because he was sort of her little minion.
And, you know, and this is why what happens at the University of Mordor keeps happening over and over again.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we've talked at length on this podcast before not just the Mordor thing, but about the Puritan environment that's created in schools. Like, I will always remember in secondary school, there was this huge scandal about two boys who were caught, like, giving each other blowjobs in the toilet, and, like, they were expelled.
They were expelled.
You know, and looking at the time, I was like, oh yeah, whatever, you know
blow it's job.
Like yeah blow job yeah. You know, not in this specific voice, but like, you know, it made sense at the time, because I was so part of that way of thinking that this was an infraction of the highest fucking order, right? But actually, if you look back at it now, it's like,
you reroute
this kid's entire educational journey because of something that, as a teenager, it's like bound to happen, what? Mm. You know, yesterday I was having this conversation with our friend about how, like, actually teenage boys fool around each other all the time, and it's perfectly natural, right? And then, like, side note here, I didn't, so I felt like I want to, can I redeem my secondary school
points?
Points, please. Like, I never.
Still got points or not?
Okay, my points haven't expired yet, right? Where's my, like, cheeky blowjob in the toilet? Anyway.
You want your passion card?
Okay, let's not. But
Boy
then you know,
passion.
And then I've heard many similar stories of queer kids, or you know, being policed for their sexuality. Sometimes not even in this outright way. Like, they don't have to escalate to like sex in the toilet for it to happen, right? Things like you know, hairstyles, and you know, holding hands and stuff like that. And it's just like, wow, this orthodoxy is really fucking toxic, and it's. You know, this is why when people talk about 377A, right, it's not about the law, it's about this kind of trickle down attitude that is affecting people as young as teenagers, you know, and telling them from a very young age, oh, you are perverted, you're abject, you're not normal.
It's affecting what people say, their behaviors, all of it.
And then, like, to route back to the Hacking Unicorn article, right, you know, there were some accounts there about how if you go to your school counselor to talk about, I mean, allegedly, and I don't know if it's still the case, but if you went to a school counselor to talk about it, right, I think that they're obliged by policy to tell your fucking parents and out you if you come up to them as queer. And to me, it's just like, wow, what kind of mental health environment is this creating? And what kind of, this is a very thoroughly inhumane way of looking at sexuality and identity and anything. And you know, it makes me so sad to think about how vulnerable these kids must feel in that position to go and talk to an adult about these things that they are told are so dark and abject and, you know, dirty. And then to be brave enough to talk to someone about it and then to be told, oh, now I got to doubt your parents.
Yeah,
you know?
To be immediately betrayed.
Yeah, by the system. And it just makes me so upset to think about how, like, schools are still this kind of environment. And it's an incredible contradiction that keeps coming up in this conversation between kind-hearted, progressive, loving people such as yourselves who've been part of the system. And though not many such teachers exist, right? But then also battling against a kind of system that's anxious and paranoid and actually quite cynical. You know, it must be such a difficult environment to be an adult, a thinking adult, to be part of the system.
The entire Singapore is a place of contradiction.
Yeah, but then
we
like,
talked about this.
Yeah, yeah. But then to be surrounded by young people, you know, on the cusp of all this confusing change in their life, right? And then to have to be a gatekeeper or an agent of this system. Wow, I can't imagine that headspace. And it makes you think, oh, actually, this is why Singapore is like that. It's because our schools are like that. Mm. You know, it's like we learn to become subjects of the system in school, right?
Yeah. And I recently called, you know, that moment right before term starts and you're about to open the door to the staff room out into the wilderness. And I'm just like, I just think about it like a minefield, like a moral minefield.
What new horrors await?
Wow, yeah, moral minefield.
Because it's like five voices in your head, right? Battling what the most appropriate response to the wise quips that come your way are. Like, okay, here got fat shaming. Okay, here got racially problematic things. Oh, next, two steps down got this fella. Like, gonna call you Aqua. Then now they got, you know.
Wow, this is real. Like, this is a Tuesday.
It's just a Tuesday. Yeah, Tuesday morning.
Yeah, really.
Friday afternoon. Anywhere you go, through the canteen, through the corridor, through the hallway, you gonna all of this, and it's like, in your brain, which one to address? Address now.
Absolutely.
Address according to my own values or according to what I'm supposed to be espousing. And then like, where do I stand? And then what comes out of my mouth to this child?
And then what happens though when you just so patently disagree with what you are being made to teach or being made to present? Like, have you ever had those experiences where like you're made to present something and you're just like, this is bullshit and I'm going to tell you the truth instead?
Oh, 100%. I just do what I want to do unless I'm being supervised. So it's Racial Harmony Day, and then you have these slides that descend upon you from MOE that you're meant to present to these kids, like all your usual. I think from our time never changed. Mariah Hartog.
It's like, this is why we cannot.
This is why we cannot talk about race, but we can wear the sari.
Best.
Yeah. So I was done with those slides pretty fast, I think just because I couldn't turn.
Right.
She's like, okay, like that, finish. And then, so I had a lot of time and I just thought, let's open the floor and kind of, anybody has anything to say about race or what do you think race is? What is your experience of race or ethnicity in any form in Singapore in your 15 years of living kind of thing? You know, all these little stories came out about casual racism or happy stories about you know, sharing or really sort of color blindness in their neighborhood or, you know, like all kinds of stories came up and I just layan lah. I just let the stories happen and I was very careful to not, you know, be prescriptive or whatever because I was still quite new at the time. I didn't want to get in trouble. But then,
behind the pillar,
Polonius.
A wild HOD appears.
Yeah, and she was the head of CCE, Character and Citizenship Education. And I had a stern talking down to after, just for acknowledging that different people of different races have different types of experience as a result of their ethnicity. In Singapore, which has achieved perfect racial harmony. She's like, you know, it's a slippery slope, you know, when if you're not Chinese and then you everything is because I'm Malay, everything is because I'm Indian and nothing is my fault.
Was this a Chinese person?
Of course lah.
Of course lah.
Yeah, and you know, you don't want to train them into these ways of thinking. And besides, what else do you want from what other country can you find? Blah 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 blah.
Wow, that's really that's the orthodox position, man.
It's all the things you expect,
even down to the what other country? Yeah, wow.
Everything you expect of it just came out of me, and you know, it's such a harmful way of teaching your students to think and to bring these issues to light. You might think you're doing something good, but actually reinforcing these divides are going to breed resentment and
right. I think, like what I was saying just now, things have shifted very much, and the government and MOE cannot keep their heads in the sand, like, and these discussions actually do happen in class now, but like I was saying, it's how are teachers trained to carry out these discussions, and where are the landing points? These are my questions, lah. And who decides these landing points?
Right.
You know,
because
are my questions.
Is the guided conversation about race eventually going to fold everything back to orthodoxy, or is there still going to be room for people to go, actually, the orthodox position is pretty shit?
Yeah.
You know, because my sense is that, like, it's a guided conversation that will eventually guide people back to, actually, it's still okay, yeah, lah. Actually, it's not too bad. Why?
Yeah.
Okay. Why? Okay. Yeah. Why?
Yeah, is it all theater, lah? Basically,
correct.
You know,
it's like, maybe let's entertain some of these, like, slightly naughty thoughts, but in the end, let's come back to, like, the fold.
Well,
you know?
What has your experience been, Kishan, with like these new updated CCE things?
I've had these conversations in the classroom before, and like you, I'm always very careful not to be prescriptive and to just let students share, and the sharing is freaking rich, you know, especially with minority students,
yeah,
or minority, however you want to define it, you know, especially minority students, if they're brave enough to want to share, and it is a brave thing to do in like one student in 40 to share your own experience, it's really well done. It's been good. I think teachers are learning how to do it. My take back from this is that many teachers are afraid to do this, even if it's okay. The feedback you get from teachers is like, oh, I don't know how to talk about this.
There you go.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what to do. I'm not trained. The word train comes out a lot. Should I go for a course? You know, all these things come out. And
but they should though.
Yeah, they should just go for a training. Yeah,
they should. But many from my sensing would rather not. Many because they're still very scared. Because let's say they're trained and go for a course, they're very scared and they want to know where the OB markers are because they want to know what they cannot say.
The fear is so real because it's not just about, like, say, even if there's no other adult in the school that day and I'm at liberty to say whatever the fuck I want to these kids, or we're in the AVA room and nobody can see, you know. Any one of these kids who might have been raised by a racist would just go home, tell their mother, who will come, and then you, it's a whole thing. You're going to get into trouble. It's going to be investigations. It's going to be months and months of like facing the consequences of that.
We have a long way to go. But like what I keep saying, things are changing. And I feel it a lot in schools now. Like sometimes when I hear, like for example, when you, Joel, when you talk about your experiences in school, and I think about what I go through, I realize there's actually a huge difference. So things have really, truly moved on.
I mean, good lah.
Yeah, I know. It's a good thing.
Good.
But of course, I wish it moved faster. I wish it moved to a little bit more direction. I wish people were all on board for the ride, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things I wish for. Change is happening incrementally, but it is happening.
For the past few years, I've been writing for this newspaper called What's Up for primary to secondary school students. And it's run by Dr. Cherian George and his sister, Dr. Mary George.
Noted dissidents.
noted dissidents. And I was like, it was Yi Sheng.
Yi Sheng, the poet and playwright.
Who I think needed to take a break for a while. I was looking for someone to fill in the articles he could manage to write. And that's when I was introduced. And I was just so happy because the paper covers so much of just shit, like, you know, good shit, like world news. And their whole thing is about not sugarcoating ugly news, but still couching it or framing it in a way that allows a reader to remain optimistic or to find some agency or, you know, have some sort of call to action or, you know, kind of look at a way out of this shitty situation.
It's so great Cherian George stuff. I love
it's
that.
It's great.
Yeah.
So like every month, I don't know what I'll get. I'll get like Trump versus Kim. Then one, I'll get like the history and science behind bridges and how they're built. Like
that's very interesting.
Really anything.
So diverse.
But then you also wrote this series of conversations about race. Right?
I have so many questions about that.
Raving about this paper. Okay, so yes. So more recently, the writers were invited to pitch a series of articles that would exist primarily online, but some of the articles got picked and printed as well. But the full series is up online. And so I pitched a series of articles about racism in Singapore. And I guess through the conversation, we're like, okay, let's talk about casual racism to sort of start small, right? And don't hit too hard yet. Just kind of the small things we take for granted. Yeah, and so I collected a bunch of stories through interviews, and I'm like hyper aware that I am Chinese,
right?
And like, who am I to be prescribing or talking about these experiences that aren't mine? So I kind of play the role of an interviewer and just listen and sort of collect these anecdotes and then reorder them into more engaging and dynamic pieces. And they just kind of shared stories of like, problematic things they hear every day, things they don't even think about anymore, or just, you know, people feeling like minority people feeling like they need to act Chinese to fit in,
right?
Or, you know, kind of self-inflicted casual racism, or taking compliments like, wow, you're very pretty for an Indian girl. But, you know, you don't question that as a kid. And when you grow up, you're like, ouch. You know, and so all of these stories kind of ordered into themes.
I think, like, I just think now, when I was in school and I had someone writing these critical pieces about queerness, how much more empowered I would have been at that age to go, oh, actually, I'm okay. I don't need to keep crying under my sheets every night, you know? Or even if I do, it's not a phase or whatever, right? And then I guess in the case of, like, you know, my minority race experience, to go, actually, that's not okay what you just said to me, Amanda.
Yeah.
Amanda, that's not okay what you just said to me. And I'm going to tell you why.
Yeah.
So I think it's so encouraging to hear that this... And I understand that this is actually distributed quite widely in schools, right? This paper. That's great.
And I mean, generally, the paper is a great resource as well for talking about, like, politics, social issues, all kinds of things, but written, pitched to... a 9-year-old, basically.
I love that.
Yeah, I know teachers who use it, actually. So they say it's great. Yeah.
Nice.
Amazing.
Remember last time when we were young, what we had? We had Young Generation magazine.
Oh my God.
Worm Club.
I forgot about that.
I'm not sure what those things taught us, except that vampires were real and that bookworms wore glasses.
Yeah,
like, what the fuck even was that?
And there was a character called Fat Annie.
Fat Annie.
That's not okay.
And then Simone the lesbian. I mean, she wasn't a lesbian, but like, I look at her as like clearly lesbian.
Yeah, she was a lesbian.
I don't remember Fat Annie.
She was called Fat Annie.
Oh, that's
And there was also a boy called Pocky.
There was a fat Malay girl as well.
Oh, yeah, Pocky.
Right?
That's Fat Annie.
That's Fat Annie. She was a fat Malay girl.
Yeah.
And then, like, Smarty.
Cuckoo.
Smarty was a Chinese boy.
And the Indian boy is called Cuckoo.
Fucking racist. Yeah. And it's just like, they go on these bizarre, meaningless adventures into don't know what. And I'm just like, wow, I'm just so glad that now we have, you know, this is what racism looks like. Much better content. All right.
Wow. What a rich discussion.
What a rich discussion.
Rich and good.
We've come to the end of today's
episode.
It's a cake shop.
What, rich and good?
Yeah. Rich and good cake shop.
Is that really?
It's really very rich and good.
Where is it?
I forgot. Okay. A very bad street name.
Yeah, but it's a good cake shop.
You just go to the Instagram. You can find.
Rich and good. Rich and good. This kind of free. Oh, speaking of cakes, we want to thank... Sorry, we do sponsorship. Thank you.
Yeah, not sponsored.
Is it Sheng Xiong?
No. Sheng Xiong Supermarket has yet to sponsor this fucking podcast.
Yeah. Someone else has come in, Sheng Xiong.
Da Pi Ku, which is like this home run business that sells the most delicious sweets.
Amazing
cakes and cookies. Very kindly not sponsored, like, they just like sent some treats over to Kishan and I the other day. And we just worked through the whole thing.
Yeah, they just like randomly Instagram, like, can we feed you? We're like, yes.
Yes. And we took it and we ate it.
We ate it all.
And we loved it all.
Yeah,
so
it
thank
really
you very much,
Dapiku. Thank you.
Yeah, that's it's
everything. Great name.
Everything very salty and sweet and
go and buy their stuff. Just Google Dapiku, I guess.
Yeah,
this is we're terrible pluggers.
No, we're terrible at this. This is why Sheng Xiong.
You just Google lah, you'll find one.
This is why Sheng Xiong will never sponsor us, because they sponsor us. What will we do? Oh, anyway, we come to the end of today's episode.
Yes,
I had such a great time today talking
me
about
too.
Like traumatic school experiences.
Huh?
But also with
view to a hopeful future.
Yeah, definitely hopeful. That. Mm. Definitely that.
Thanks so much, Weish, for joining us.
Yes, for having
I hope
me.
You, I hope you enjoy down. Yourself as
I've
much as you enjoy having
fan.
You.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm blushing.
All right, thank you for listening. This has been Joel.
And this is Kishan.
And this is Weish.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.